So I'm just going to talk for a little while as an introduction to not just the stage of spiritual death, but also the stage of spiritual rebirth. I'm going to do them both together, and then we can just get on with meditating for a couple of days. So I've been talking to this Nidana chain, and pointing out the way in which we move away from primary experience into a secondary experience, which is constructed upon our primary experience, our reactions to the, especially the pleasure and pain content of those, that primary experience. And we've been looking at the way in which the stage of integration brings us back to our basic experience, the basic sparsha, vedana, and identification of the world around us. And that the stage of positive emotion brings positive intentions into play in relation to that primary experience. So we deal with it skillfully, helpfully to ourselves and to others. But of course, positive emotion goes further and deeper than well-wishing, or well-wishing goes further than deeper than merely having thoughts of well-wishing. Skillful action leads to karmic resultants. It leads to karma vipaka. And as you act more and more skillfully, as you generate more and more skillful action, well, you experience a fulfillment. You experience an enrichment. So I've been talking about an enriching and deepening of your experience, and that is a karmic consequence. So it's as a result of your skillful action, of your, first of all, being integrated with, of being mindful of your primary experience and not reacting to it, and then your skillful action in relation to it, your experience unfolds with a greater richness and depth. So the whole sort of early realm of spiritual life is really to do with karma vipaka, karma and karma vipaka. Dhyana, in the end, is a karma vipaka. It's very clear when you read the early texts, the Samanapala Sutta, for instance, which is a kind of root text of the basic path. The Buddha talks about, first of all, renunciation, then an ethical life. There's a lot, that all three or four different versions of precepts are given. An ethical life, so that you're living skillfully. And as a result of living skillfully, you're happy. Happiness is a result of your innocent life. Then as a result of being happy, you become concentrated. You just sit and your mind naturally collects itself. And it naturally, in accordance with the purity of your mind, it naturally begins to touch on higher realms of consciousness. One can make effort, of course, but you can only make that effort to the degree that you've got the basis for it, the karmic basis for it. So the when I say the early stages of spiritual life, I mean for many lifetimes, a large part of it is to do with working with karma. You're working with the karma niyama. You could say that prapancha takes place because you've identified yourself almost entirely with nature, with the three lower niyamas. You've not seen that there's a karmic force to be taken into consideration. So you're a sophisticated animal, you might say. Your vitaka, your intelligence is being used for the sake of well, human animal aspirations and interests. But the spiritual life works with a kama niyama. To begin with, you're aligning yourself more and more with the kama niyama, so that your actions are aligned, yes, aligned with the kama niyama. This current, you could almost say, within reality, that means that skillful action brings fulfillment, inner satisfaction and happiness, if not always, of course, a smooth life from an external point of view, because that's due to the other niyamas. But internally, you'll gain more and more satisfaction, pleasure, fulfillment, well, sort of self-respect, self-confidence, and so on. So, yes, I've talked about primary experience gaining richness and depth. That's under the result of the action of the karma niyama. But that's not the end of it. There's another niyama. There's the dhamma niyama. And to begin with, in a way, you can only work with the dhamma niyama by following the Buddha's teachings. But eventually, the dhamma niyama becomes a force within your own life, you might say. This is part of what I was talking to Bhante about in these interviews I've mentioned. We were talking quite a bit about the niyamas. He had a lot to say about the niyamas. He was saying that it's the dhamma niyama that makes Buddhahood possible. It's that which it, within reality, that makes Buddhas arise, makes enlightenment possible. There's something about the way reality works that brings enlightenment. So just as there's something about reality, the way reality works, that means that when you act skillfully, you'll gain spiritual depth and richness. You'll gain in satisfaction, inner satisfaction. In the same way, when you align yourself with the Dhamma Niyama, you will understand reality more and more deeply. He spoke of it not merely as a sort of a description. It's not that the Dhamma Niyama is a description of what happens. It's as if it's almost a kind of a force. Of course, it's not exactly a force. It's only a metaphor. But it's once you start to align yourself with it, it begins to operate independently of your will. It begins to manifest in your life and behaviour. Do you see what I mean? We don't want to go to the extreme of a kind of vitalism or whatever. But at the same time, we need to recognise there's something about the universe which is active, which is dynamic, that once you begin to align yourself with it, it takes you forward and it unfolds and eventually leads to your full realization. Bhante talked about this in terms of his own experience of, first of all, of connecting with the Dhamma when reading the Diamond Sutra, and he said he experienced a huge release of energy and a great sense of joy through his contact with the Dhamma at a very, very lofty level. It sort of worked within him. It changed his experience and, released a huge amount of energy and joy. And he said, at various times in his life, he's felt as if he was being worked through. It's a metaphor. Don't fix it too much. But he talked particularly of that time when he was in Nagpur, in Bombay, and had arranged to go to Nagpur to be with the new Buddhists who converted just 6 weeks before. And his friend Dr. Mehta, if you've read the memoirs, he tried to stop him. But Bhante knew he had to go. And he arrived there and, of course, was greeted with the news that Dr. Ambedkar had died. And he said that for the next 3 or 4 days, he functioned without thinking. He gave many talks. He said he never thought about what he was going to say, but whatever what he said appeared, as it were, in his mouth, and was exactly what needed to be said. And without saying that somebody was doing something through him, it was as if it was something more than him at work. So when we're talking about the Dhamma Niyama, we need to think of something that sort of operates beyond our normal self, our normal experience, that we're opening up to, that we're trying to, yes, align ourselves with. Our practice of the Dhamma, to a large extent, is aligning ourselves with this force, this current that's inherent in reality. That's all there is to be said, really. But it's a very, very powerful and important point, which warrants a great deal of reflection. It's not just a matter of kind of common sense, of realizing something and there you go. It's a question of something opening up, which is far bigger than you, and that, in a sense, sort of works through you. Bhante spoke of the Garava Sutta, which we'll read tonight in the puja. In the Garava Sutta, he's talked about it in a number of places. Just after the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha thinks to himself, it's painful not to look up to something. It's painful not to rely on something. So what is that that I can live reverencing and relying upon? And so then he says, well, there's no human being I can do that with. There's nobody who's greater in realization than me. There's nobody who understands life better than me. And so I can't rely on any human being. So what will I rely upon? And he says then, let me live reverencing the Dhamma, relying upon the Dhamma. And Bhante says he thinks this is a tremendously significant passage, which he finds it strange is not really commented on in the Pali Canon. Looking for it this morning, I found another passage where one of the Arahat Bhikshus talks about himself relying upon the Buddha and reverencing the Buddha. There's a footnote, and the translator, Bhikkhu Bodhi, says, this seems rather strange that he's an arahant, but he still reveres and reverences the Buddha. So, clearly something hasn't been sort of nothing's been made of this. Whereas Bhante says he thinks it's tremendously significant that what it implies is that the Buddha's realization was in a sense not enough. His realization connected him to something, some principle, if you like, but principle is too kind of flat a word, not sufficiently dynamic or transcendent, you could say. He was connected to something that was greater than him, which his realization was a realization of. And he suggested that maybe that this is what is being got at in later tradition when it talks of the Buddha Amitabha sort of standing behind the Buddha Shakyamuni. There's a kind of transcendental, universal, I won't say abstract, Buddha, who the human historical Buddha kind of reveres, looks up to, and relates to, relies upon. What you could say is that the Buddha is still a human being. So he's still living as a human being. He's got a human body, he's got a human brain, and therefore a certain sort of human mechanism. So even though his realization is beyond time, above time, as a human being, he stands in relation to that, beyond time, if you see what I mean. In talking about it and trying to sort of get to grips with it, Bhante sort of stressing that he's very reluctant to talk about these things. They're so easily sentimentalized, so easily reified, so easily drift into, you know, grand abstractions, so easily lead to people thinking they've understood something because they've got a form of words. He said in the end he thinks it's a mystery. And it's a mystery which we shouldn't try to understand. In a way, we should recognize that there's something that the Buddha realizes and that we can begin to contact that cannot be understood in our ordinary terms, and that our spiritual lives are to an extent an attempt to open up to. So he thinks it's far better to give as little content to that as possible. And this is his quarrel with later Mahayana and so forth, which fills the void with lots of grand metaphysical abstractions. His distrust of terminology of Tathagata Garbha and so forth. He thinks that this sort of then imposes on the mystery something that appears to be intelligible. And it may have some positive effect, may come out of people's genuine experience, but he thinks the danger is that it easily stands between you and the mystery. Of course, the danger of leaving it as a mystery is that you think it's blank. So how to pitch it just right down the middle. And he said he thinks, for instance, if you're talking about your own experience, your own even spiritual experience, even some kind of vision experience, don't reach for ready-made concepts. He said, describe the raw experience. Don't try to fit it into some categories and say it's this or that, whether they're categories to do with Buddhist metaphysics or categories, to do with this realization or that realization, this level or that level. Just describe the experience. And, if people have had that experience, so they'll recognize what you're talking about. If they haven't, well, they'll get some inkling of it because all experience, has echoes for others if you describe it honestly enough. So, yes, he's saying that there's a mystery. The Buddha fully engages with a mystery that our spiritual lives are lived to see, if you can see a mystery, to immerse ourselves in. And that's what we're beginning to do in the stage of spiritual death and the stage of spiritual rebirth. In the stage of spiritual death, we're letting go, we're giving up those things that prevent us from experiencing the mystery. Those things that prevent the Dhamma Niyama working itself out through us. We're systematically disentangling ourselves from our identification of ourselves with our physical bodies, with the physical elements, thinking that that's who we are, thinking of our minds in those terms, thinking of our experience in those terms, thereby closing them off, narrowing them down, so the Dhamma Niyama can't manifest within us. It's got no chance, no opportunity. There's no hole, as it were, through which it can seep. Although it sometimes does sort of burst through in spontaneous ways under odd circumstances. But yeah, first of all, you need to, we need to loosen our hold on our tight grasping onto the physical elements as me, and learn to experience them, but without grasping. In a way, that's what you're doing in with mindfulness, actually. You're trying to see what's there without any sense of mine. You know, even when we're looking through the body and seeing the sensations of having a body, of, you know, of touch and so forth, we're trying to just see them without any sense of grasping onto them. But we need to much more systematically undo our identification with the physical elements. So when we do the six element practice, we're engaging in that process. We're recognizing that there's nothing in each of the elements, earth, water, fire and air, that is permanent, that's substantial, that we can call our own, and we're giving it up. It's interesting in the Pali version of the practice, in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta in Majjhima Nikaya, it talks about feeling nibindati, having the experience of nibida. Do you remember in the positive nidanas? Nibida, which means usually disentanglement, sometimes even disgust, a sense of, I don't want, not just, oh, let go, but of give up, let go. It's holding me down, it's tacky, it's holding me back. And then virajati, which of course is viraga, which is what follows on, which is dispassion. In other words, indifference, you're not interested. And the interesting thing is that these come on after Yathabhuta Jnana Darshana, don't they? Which is the point when the Dhamma Niyama begins to decisively operate within you, irreversibly operate within you. It's the point when you enter the stream. The stream is the stream of Dhamma Niyama. You've entered that conditioning process, that process of Pratitya Samutpada, which leads on to enlightenment. So you're letting go of what prevents that from unfolding. And then when you come to the space element, you're getting some sort of preliminary feeling of spaciousness, because you're letting go of a limited experience of space. So you're connecting with a much larger field of consciousness, and then you're seeing that consciousness, well, it's got nothing to identify itself with in the five elements. Consciousness is pure subjectivity, you could say. So it has no identity by definition. Do you see what I mean? That identity belongs to the objective world. It's objects that are identified, distinguished from other things. But consciousness is the act, it's not actually a thing at all. It's the act of knowing objects. Bhante suggested in these discussions that he once tried to use a verbal form of consciousness, which is consiring, C-O-N-S-C-I-R-E, I-N-G rather. And we both agreed that probably it wouldn't catch on. But it means, you know, the act of knowing, the act of being conscious. It's connected with science. So consciousness isn't a thing. We talk about it as if it was a table or a chair. My consciousness, you know, so we say, my consciousness leaves my body at death, as if, you know, your shirt came off and went on to somebody else. It's not like that. If consciousness is the act of knowing. So when you're not identifying anything as mine within the objective world, there's nothing for consciousness to be attached to. So consciousness is just conscious. It's just being conscious. In the text, in the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, the Buddha talks about it as being parishuddha pariyodhata, which means very pure and very bright. So what you experience when you cease to identify with the elements, the physical elements, is a consciousness that is undefined, luminous, knowing, but without a knower, and without a source, as it were, of light. It's just pure knowing. And Bhante says then, well, just see what happens. You've sort of pushed your boat out into the middle of the stream. See where the stream takes you. See what unfolds in your experience. What happens to consciousness. Of course, you may need to continue to just disentangle as your consciousness goes back to clinging and grasping. You just sort of disentangle. But essentially what you're doing is allowing something to happen. Seeing what's left when you leave this space. And the space that you're leaving is the space within which the Dhamma Niyama can begin to emerge or unfold. So the stage of spiritual death is dying to those things that obscure the Dhamma Niyama, those things that hold you back from the Dhamma Niyama. It's those things that you cling to that prevent the stream from carrying you along. It's as if you're, well, we're in the midst of reality, where therefore the Dhamma Niyama is playing upon us all the time. In a sense, the Dhamma Niyama operates through the other Niyamas, getting dangerously close to metaphysicalizing it all. But we remain, as it were, safe from the Dhamma Niyama, because we cling to the elements, we cling to the skandhas, we cling to mine, I. And when we relax, which is what we do in this sixth element practice, there's an opportunity for the Dhamma Niyama to begin to operate through us. And what actually happens, it's best not to say too much. Because when you speak about it too much, you start to sort of prepackage what happens. And it's very, very difficult not then to sort of think you're having an experience that you're not actually having, to sentimentalize it or reify it. So Bhante prefers you're leaving a space within the myth, a mystery has the opportunity of unfolding. And of course, nothing may happen. But you repeatedly do the practice, you disentangle more and more, and there's more and more of an opportunity for something to emerge. So that's the stage of spiritual death. What about the stage of spiritual rebirth? Because in a way, the Dhamma Niyama working within you is rebirth, is spiritual rebirth. You've died to a self connected with the three lower niyamas, and even in a way the karma niyama. And when you die to that, something else takes over. But we need some sort of way of approaching that. We need some way of worshipping the Dhamma Niyama. It's not enough just to have a golden Dhamma chakra. It's very difficult to feel the golden Dhamma chakra is sort of worthy of reverence. It can be just a sort of shorthand for a pile of books. Maybe it isn't for some people. Very interesting. There's the fascinating suttas in which the golden wheel appears in the sky. The wheel of the wheel-turning monarch, and so on. But yes, it's in a way an abstract symbol. It doesn't carry, well, for me at least, it doesn't carry a kind of numinous power, a sense of something coming from another dimension. And we need that. Because without revering and relying upon something, life is suffering. Of course, we can rely and revere the Buddha. And we're very, very fortunate. The Buddha is a historical personage who we know quite a lot about. And Bhante says he thinks that we need to know, we need to sort of focus much, much more on the historical Buddha. All the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas only have their meaning because of the historical Buddha. So we need to sort of ground ourselves again and again in the historical Buddha, because he embodies that transcendence. But in a way, we need to have a bit of a glimpse almost beyond the historical Buddha. We need a glimpse of what it is that makes him the Buddha. And, we get this from the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They embody the Dhamma Niyama at a point beyond our human horizon. Bhante speaks of them as being on the horizon of our experience. What's beyond the horizon, we can't imagine. But there, where that horizon, well, where what's beyond that horizon meets us. And they allow us to connect with something way beyond our own present experience, our present consciousness, our present way of experiencing. And they give us something to revere, to rely upon, and to aspire to, and even to serve. We can do that with the human historical Buddha, because he's for us to some extent also an archetype. He goes beyond the human and the historical. But through these the practices that we were given at ordination, we've been given a means of connection with the Dhamma Niyama in an embodied form, in a personified form, albeit a transcendental person, you know, without, as it were, human characteristics in the ordinary sense, which is much more approachable for us. You remember in the Three Jewels, I remember talking about this on one or other of the Guhyalokas that some of you are on. He talks about to think of enlightenment as impersonal is to think of it as subpersonal. It is better to think of it as suprapersonal. Do you see what I mean? So if you think of the enlightenment as something impersonal, the impersonal for us is something that has no personality. In other words, it's subpersonal, because personal is the highest category we know. So you need to think of enlightenment as something beyond a person. And the best way you can do that is thinking of a transcendent personality. Is that clear? So that when we visualize the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, we're connecting with this principle, the Dhamma Niyama, an active force which is the dynamic of the whole of reality in terms of these figures, which are not literally what it is, but they're the nearest approach we can get to it from our sense-based, albeit sublimated sense faculties. So that's what these two stages are about. The stage of spiritual death focuses on letting go so that something can happen. Not just letting go, Bhante stressed. He doesn't think that the terminology of letting go is enough. You need to think of giving up, something much more active that goes a little bit against the grain. We are definitely putting down, getting rid of, putting aside, so that something can begin to emerge. And in the visualization practices, you're connecting with the closest you can come to what that mystery is without falsifying it. He thinks that metaphysical formulae easily falsify, and that you get much closer to it in imaginative terms, imaginal terms, archetypal terms, albeit transcendentalized archetypes, not mere archetypes, but archetypes that are invested with a transcendent meaning. And that when you contemplate those, you're drawn up, you're allowing the Dhamma Niyama to affect you directly. So I hope this is a helpful way of talking. This is hot off the press, and gaining clarity in my own mind as I'm speaking. But I find it especially helpful that we should think of the universe as constructed with a built-in tendency towards enlightenment. Bhante says very tentatively, in a way you could see this in all the niyamas. You can see that the physical inorganic niyama sort of transcends itself in the sort of biological creation. It's out of it comes life, living matter, and then you can see that living matter fulfills itself in the intelligence of the animal, the instinctive intelligence of the animal, the manoniyama, which operates in us too. A lot of what we are is this instinctive intelligence, albeit at a very sophisticated level, and that fulfills itself in the kama niyama, in self-consciousness. Self-consciousness is the basis of ethics. It's when self-consciousness is there that there's a relationship between the self and the world. So the kama niyama is the fulfillment of the mano niyama, you could say. And the dhamma niyama it kind of emerges out of the kama niyama, because when you are fully operating in harmony with the kama niyama, the dhamma niyama can manifest. When you are fully skillful, when you're living a life of ethical purity, when your mind is deeply immersed in higher mental states, the dhamma niyama emerges. So this force of self-transcendence, this transcending force, is present at every level of reality. And what we're doing in our spiritual lives is aligning ourselves with that. And everything that we're doing, even during these days, is an alignment with those forces. What we're doing in these practices, first of all, is getting out of our sort of false construction of reality, which our self-consciousness allows us to do. Our mano-niyama emerges with a self-conscious dimension, and we mistake its character, and we become immersed in seeking satisfaction through the senses, albeit in very complex ways. So that we're lost in prapancha. We come back to ordinary basic awareness. And then we make that skillful through maitri and through skillful action, which begins to emerge as richer and richer experience of life in aesthetic terms. Aesthetic in the worldly sense, and aesthetic in the dhyanic sense. And what we then need to do is work at letting go of our grasp onto the lower niyamas, our identification with the lower niyamas, our identification with the elements, and allowing something to emerge within us. We don't know what, but we have confidence, we have faith that will happen. Our faith is the first glimmering of the Dhamma Niyama. Faith is the first sort of sense of being pulled upwards beyond ourselves. And with the six element practice, we're deliberately letting go our hold on the on the elements, even on the lower niyamas, our identification with the lower niyamas, and with the visualization practices, we're engaging, we're opening up to the Dhamma niyama as embodied in these transpersonal personalities, and thereby allowing the Dhamma to affect us much more fully, much more deeply. So there you are. We're going to do it now. A lot to reflect on, but a lot to work with. And I think the main thing is that as we approach these two dimensions of practice, try to get that sense of mystery and of faith that something will emerge. Those seem to be the key terms. A sense of faith, but almost you could say, you don't know what in. A faith in something that you're absolutely confident is beneficent and is supremely beneficent, but you don't know what it is. You can't put it into words. You know you can't put it into words, or you know that any words you put it into will miss something about it. And yes, you give yourself up to that. That's what these two practices are really about.